doop. This just in. Rockwell P. Schrock.
Try again.
I don't recall your middle name. Rockwell P. Schrock says VS Code integration is first rate.
You skipped a couple items before that.
Oh, well, has Sublime been ripped from your cold, dead hands?
Man, I still love me some Sublime, man. Get in, get out. It's fast. It does what my fingers want it to do. The sync between two computers actually works.
Isn't VS Code working on that, though? They're doing like a first-party sync?
I hope so.
I'm pretty sure they are. I mean, to be fair, I never had problems with the third-party one that VS Code has, but it is a pain to set up because you have to go and remember your GIST IDs and all that.
Yeah, and the problem with that is it requires remembering to do it, whereas with Sublime, you just point it at a Dropbox or some kind of synced directory, and the settings just go back and forth. I think I'm using my Synology Drive now, which is like their roll-your-own Dropbox clone. Because I completely uninstall Dropbox from my Mac, and it's great. It's kind of frustrating, actually, but I just couldn't deal with it anymore, man.
We just got a Dropbox business account because a ton of vendors just want Dropbox, so we're like, fine, we'll set one up. Can confirm. What are you confirming, Thomas? Thomas from the chat.
Dropbox is a piece of shit.
Oh, we're going to have to mark explicit now.
No, I can edit. I'm going to edit the crap out of it.
Yeah, no, I'll just use it. I'm just using the browser version of Dropbox. I didn't want to install it. I don't install Google Drive either. We use that pretty heavily at Sidedoor and DK. Just get them. I use iCloud Drive a lot, though, personally.
I would use it, too, if I upgraded to Catalina so I could get shared folders.
You're not on Catalina?
No. I kind of hesitated updating. I'm in Mojave 10.14.6 currently. And then just all the horror stories about Catalina just kept pushing me back and back. The whole reason I didn't upgrade is because I didn't want my... There's always that fear that it's going to mess up your development environment, especially with
right.
Homebrew and all open source technologies. I'm sure it'd be fine. I should probably just do it one of these times, but Paul mentioned to me the other day, like, don't do it. It's just paper cuts all the way down, man.
Yeah. It's been fine for me, honestly, but yeah, don't test it, right? It's like playing chicken.
Playing chicken with the Oscar Mayer Wienermobile.
I learned a term this week called COD timing, Call of Duty timing, I guess. I heard it on some streams. It's like always in the wrong spot at the wrong time. There happens to be someone just like got to the place right before you. They're just randomly there and you lose because of it.
Is that what the macOS upgrade experience is like?
Yeah, right. It's like everything's fine, and then you finally do update. It's been a couple, I don't know, like a year or whatever, and then suddenly there's an issue, some sort of error. How long are you going to wait before you upgrade to an ARM or an Apple SoC system?
Yesterday, if I could.
Oh.
No, I don't know. I'm really curious to see what they come out with. If it's a laptop, it's going to be a hard time swallowing that as a beginning, because I love my 16-inch. It's great.
I don't say that.
Need to upgrade. The keyboard is so nice, Sean. You know what happens? Here's the thing, okay?
Don't say that to me.
I have a keyboard on my 16-inch, and guess what?
When I
type a key?
I don't want to hear it.
It just shows up once.
Don't.
It doesn't show up zero times. It doesn't show up 20 times.
Oh, man. Now you're just gaslighting me.
It just shows up once.
You know what? I had to add two new debouncers to keys to my keyboard yesterday. Was it yesterday or today? One of the days. So I posted a link I'll put it in the show notes too, dear listeners. So Rockwell is basically talking about the fact that I have to run a software debouncer because my keyboard keeps typing double keys. And so now it's the space bar, the E key, the N key, and the O key. We'll just randomly type multiple, it's not even doubles. Like a couple of times, it was typed six times in a row. So I have 40 millisecond debouncers on several keys now on my computer. I just don't want to take it in.
You know what needs debouncing? Buttons when you're using an Arduino. You know what shouldn't need debouncing? A 64-bit computer.
Yeah, it's really frustrating. And then I was honestly thinking about upgrading to the 16-inch MacBook Pro because I've heard such good things about it. And then the Apple SoC happened, and I was like, I should probably wait. I don't know. I wonder how many keys will have to be debouncing by the time those roll around.
I'm telling you, you should just do what the people over at Mechanical Keyboard subreddit do. They just bring along their little 10 keyless mechanical. I can't even say cherry switches anymore because that's too mainstream. They have like these crazy panda switches and Toper. I don't even know anymore. But anyway, they take the little mechanical keyboards and they bring them. They just set them on top of the MacBook. Just type on that. That's what you need to do when you're walking around Santa Rosa with your solar powered battery charge in your MacBook and your mechanical keyboard.
It's too hot in Santa Rosa. I'm in Santa Cruz right now. It's like 30 degrees cooler here. It feels amazing. The fog is just keeping the sun away. I haven't seen the sun in days. And I would melt in Santa Rosa if I tried to do that.
Santa Rosa weather got boring to me. Like, it was just too sunny all the time. You know what happened here yesterday in Connecticut? We had a hailstorm. There were like marbles coming down. It was awesome. It was so exciting. I love it. I missed that when I was in Santa Rosa, I gotta say.
I do like how it stays really cool, though, in the morning and evenings. I like, and it's been really windy, too. I feel like it's been consistently windy, which I really like as well, so.
Nice.
I just stay inside during the day. They fixed our air conditioner finally, so that's good. Life is good in Santa Rosa when I'm there.
I should say once COVID is over. If COVID ever gets over, you got to find some sweet hangout spots, man.
Yeah. I have a few friends now that I've met at the dog park, and we've been talking about hanging out socially whenever we're allowed to or it's safe to. Fun thing to do. I, for whatever reason, maybe it's because like where I am in Santa Cruz, I'm kind of out of the way and I don't have a car, so I never really met anybody around here besides Adrian, my tattoo artist. So I didn't there's no meetups in Aptos. They're like nothing happens in Aptos, and I don't want to ride my bike over to Santa Cruz where there probably would be meetups and then have to ride back in the dark with all the sketchy drivers here. So it feels good to have some more tech focused people, like tech focused friends that eventually maybe we'll be able to hang out IRL.
Yep.
Yeah. VS Code, I think, is where we left off.
Yeah. So you kind of buried the lead on that one. I've been learning more Python.
And you like it? You hate it?
I am quite enjoying myself, like more than I expected to. It's really interesting because it almost doesn't feel like I'm learning a new language. Like, I don't want to say like I'm good at learning new languages because I'm definitely not. I haven't done that enough to say that I'm good at it. But I think I just picked it up so naturally because it feels a lot like Ruby. I mean, they're literally like the parallels are uncanny, right? And it's basically just a different syntax and kind of a different mentality, I guess, a different approach to things. I keep coming across this word Pythonic, which to me just sounds like such a dumb word, but keeps popping up. It's funny because you go on Stack Overflow. I'm Googling like really, really beginner things, or really specific beginner things. For example, like how to deal with like, how do I filter a list, right? And then you have to go down the rabbit holes of iterators and generators and list comprehension syntax. And there's like, people are asking how to do it on Stack Overflow, beginner questions. And then one person claims this is the right way to do it. This is the one way. And like, I don't have any way to trust that person is right, except for the fact that they got tons of votes on their answer, right? That's just always been, I don't know. Python really tries to pride itself on having one way to do things. But the more you dig into it, the more you realize that, oh, this language is pretty old and you can see where it's grown and where it's adopted mentalities from other languages along the way. And you're like, oh, there's not actually one way to do anything. Yeah, you know, So it's I don't know. It's kind of a double-edged sword. I'm searching for the right analogy here, but it's...
Well, it's kind of like PHP in a way, too, because you go in there and you start Googling and you might get, well, for example, the PHP docs themselves. The PHP docs are the only docs I've ever seen that have some sort of commenting system that have like comments from a decade ago in them, right? So essentially, the commenting system from what I've read or what I've sort of observed people talking about, the commenting system is supposed to be like an addendum to the documentation. So it's people sharing additional gotchas or sharing additional ideas on how to do certain things based on the docs. And as you scroll, it's like decade old comments from PHP, like pre version 5, post version 5, version 7, you know, getting all these new features. And it's sort of like going back in time, and you can definitely see where, you know, PHP, like what it used to be and what it is now. There's like almost stress cracks in a way, mm-hmm. right? And especially Googling, because a lot of the, you know, a lot of the answers take you to Stack Overflow, which, you know, the answers have evolved over the years, or it takes you to the original docs, which have comments that are decade old. It's very, very interesting to look at.
Yeah, I'm going to invoke the C word here, Cold Fusion. Back when I was doing Cold Fusion, I think they called them live docs. I don't remember exactly, but they had a similar thing where it was just basically a commenting system at the bottom. And yeah, it was a similar thing, but it was actually, I found it, Cold Fusion was low volume enough. Not a ton of people used it, so there weren't a ton of comments to wade through. And the ones that were there were actually very, very helpful because, you know, some example in the documentation had a typo or was wrong or was explained poorly, right? So the comments were actually very, very productive for me for that. Is that kind of what you're describing for the PHP thing? Like people can just like have discussions below the pages?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I've never used them personally, but they're there.
Yeah, I always like the fact that it was just kind of in line there. You can always obviously search for it, but the fact that it was all there. Although I don't know what kind of moderation goes into that when the docs are so large and the threads go back so many years, you know?
Yeah, well, when I started digging into PHP more, people, I would say like, oh yeah, I'm reading this doc page. And they'll be like, no, go to phptherightway.com or .org or whatever it is and like follow that. That's the standard of truth, the canonical, like, yeah, source. Like if you're digging into PHP, go into PHP the right way because it'll point you to the doc pages you want to pay attention to and the ones you want to avoid because the history is so spread out. I mean, like at, you know, when it's inception, PHP didn't have classes and things like that. And so it sort of evolved into that over the time. So it has like this mix of like functionalness and OOP-ness. And with version 8, it's getting like class attributes and things like that, basically like decorators, right? So it's just growing and growing. And it's interesting even to see there was another RFC that was voted through recently. I don't recall if I was talking about this with you in the last episode. I know I've talked about this with somebody else, but basically it's sort of like some sort of match syntax. So you can essentially replace switch and case statements. And people are like, I can't wait to use this and get rid of all my switch and case statements. And it's like, those are fine. Like those are fine though, in most cases. Yeah, it's so, I don't know. The push for new, right? Like I can't wait to, there was quite a few people in this had the same idea or like the same way of thinking about it in the Twitter thread that I was looking at that was telling like, hey, this was voted through was like, oh, I can't wait to get rid of this old ancient construct.
It's funny you mentioned switch statements because as far as I can tell, Python doesn't have them.
Really?
Nor seems like they were ever supported. There's tons of like hacky ways, not even hacky ways. There's tons of different constructs you can build that simulate a switch statement. You know, you can use a map and have functions as the keys and do all these like crazy things that are just overly complicated. Or you could just do a bunch of if, else if, end. Right. And you know what? That's actually, a lot of times it's kind of what you want anyways. And so I just thought that was a weird omission. It's funny you mentioned new language features because I'm targeting Python 3.7, which is relatively new. I think 3.8 is the newest now. And like that leaves behind, I mean, Python 2 and Python 3 are largely incompatible. And so anything that's like, I don't have to worry about, I'm not a library author, right? I don't have to worry about supporting both Python 2 and Python 3 because there's this big rift in the ecosystem there, I guess. And then I get to use all the coolest new language features. You know, something that came along in Python 3.4, hell yeah, I'm going to use it. You know, I've been using type hinting, which is basically, you know, Python is Python can be duck typed, but you can add type annotations and then you have to, but they basically just add metadata to the code and then they punt the static type checking to third party libraries, much in the way that Elixir punts type checking, right?
Right.
But it's nice because the types are all in line. They read nice. They come with lots of built in types for things like optionals, right? If I want to return none, like null or a real thing. The typing system just is very robust and makes a lot of sense. And so I've taken advantage of it and I'm using all the Visual Studio Code plugins, getting back to what originally started this conversation was like all the VS Code plugins for Python. Python is old. The plugins are really mature. The documentation just works. It knows about virtual environments. You know, it knows like Ruby has Ruby environments or RBNV or whatever, RVM. Python has, of course, it has multiple things of that as well, because reasons. But Visual Studio knows about them, and it just says, like, hey, this is a virtual environment. You want me to install your stuff? I was like, yes, done. And then I installed a static type checker, so it's really fast, and it seems to do the right thing, and it gives you overrides if you need to sort of bypass it here and there. I mean, it feels like you might as well be using a statically typed language like C#. Like, that's what it feels like. It's so snappy and feels like just like I'm running C# in VS Code. That's the level of integration it has. And it seems, I just get that advantage just by adding these annotations to the code. And yeah, it makes the code a little uglier to read. You know, Python code just by its nature looks very clean to me, especially without types floating around everywhere. But obviously, you know, you're going to read this code more than you're going to write it. And having the type information there is just going to, it's only going to help you in the long run, I think.
PHP similar, right? Like with PHP, you can do the type annotations, and Laravel actually takes advantage of that too. Like they have this thing called route model binding. So when you're creating your action for a controller, if you tell it that it's going to expect, in our case, like a vendor model, then it'll automatically go out and get, if you give it an ID, it'll automatically go and get that vendor model and return it to you. So you kind of skip a step of having to get the ID, get the model associated with that ID and return it. So it sort of takes advantage of type hinting in various ways, because if you have a class and you're using it in the space of a model, then it knows where it can go look to get that information automatically for you.
That's awesome.
Yeah. There's some niceties for sure. Eloquent's been blowing my mind too. Like I'm skeptical of it all, like for performance reasons, of course. But for example, you know, I'm testing out different data that we have, and say that I've imported 20,000 products and I want to go ahead and auto approve all products that at least have one image. You know, I've done that a lot in Elixir, where I might write a function, but I have to sort of use fragments to do the query that'll get me the images and then filter out the ones that don't have any images for the products, right? In Laravel, it's product :: has images, and then it will just return me all the products that have at least one image relationship. I was like, that's cheating.
That's some black magic right there.
Some black magic is right. That's how I described it to Jaggy when I was like, this is all you have to do? He's like, yeah. And I was like, what about the opposite? He's like, oh, well, you can just pass like a conditional to that and the number you expect. So you could actually say, find me all of them that have more than two images or zero images. And it's still less than like 30 characters of typing to make that happen.
I thought Active Record was magic. And then you sent me some little snippets of that. And I was like, I don't even understand what's going on here. It's so concise.
Yeah. And what's funny is that, I guess we can back to Python in a second, but Jaggy would always tell me that Laravel, and this is, you know, this is just what he said. I don't want to generalize the entire community, but he says like, some of those tools are so good that we just don't bother to learn databases. You know, we don't bother to learn under the hood. I guess you could say the same for Active Record too, right?
Mm-hmm,
and
absolutely.
Then you start to get performance problems because you don't understand what's really happening under the hood. Or, you know, we're using Postgres, and because of Ecto, you know, I've gone through and like learned all of the syntax for Postgres string matching and fuzzy searching and stuff like that. And so I just know that off the top of my head, I remember it because I've done it a lot. And so he'll be asking me a question. He'd be like, oh, it's this, this, and this. And he'd be like, how do you know that? And I'm like, well, because I haven't had Eloquent my whole life, you know, I guess it's a testament to Ecto, right? It kind of pushes you to the actual layer that you're using, like the database. Ecto gives you a nice uniform interface for working with that, but you still have to learn about the underlying tech. But yeah, Eloquent, like, yeah, if you're spitting products out the door, Eloquent will get you there so fast. And then from there, it's the game of, oh, we have all these performance issues, let's go fix them, right?
Yeah, that's getting out the door. You shipped, right? You're supposed to ship tomorrow.
Yeah, we have some early access testers in there.
Ooh, preview, as Microsoft calls it.
Yeah. So I feel pretty okay now because I can actually ship things to the code base and not be too afraid that Jaggy's going to be like, this is all wrong, this is all bad, you know, and so I can take some pressure off of him. But I mostly stick to contributions in the side door admin area, searching, filtering, you know, tools to help data management easier, things like that.
I'm picturing Jaggy as Gordon Ramsay. And you're like the little like line chef or whatever, the understudy. And he's just yelling at you about about how you're writing PHP all wrong.
He's great. I mean, I tend to write it very procedurally, mm-hmm. i.e. functionally. And he's very quick to be like, oh, well, so you can kind of shoot yourself in the foot in 6 months if you keep doing this way. And so we can refactor this to this over here really quickly. So it's nice because he's been there, done that with Laravel, has a lot of experience there.
I love how he's already thinking 6 months into the future.
Yeah. And it's a big learning experience for me because like for example, I wanted to tweak how some of the searching stuff happens. I didn't build any of it and I wanted to tweak it. And so Elixir, it's very straightforward. There's no levels of indirection. With Laravel, I was like, all right, so I start here and then I go to this interface over there, or trait rather. I go to this trait over here and then I have to go to like this thing over there, and there's some magic binding that I just have to know about and have to go over there. And so I have my iPad and I'm like drawing a map on my iPad, you know, taking notes about the call stack and all that stuff. And then finally I arrived. I was like, oh, okay, 3 character change, you know, after 15 minutes to make it work. So, but I'm appreciating the trade-off in this case so far. The other thing that I'm not used to is caches. I'm not used to having to cache, because DK, like Phoenix, is fast enough. We didn't cache anything. We don't have to cache anything. The database layer has always been just fast enough. We don't have to worry about it. And we're caching a lot of stuff in this. So Jackie was, you know, he was happy that he got the searching to like, I don't know, I think it was like 5, you know, between 3 to 7 millisecond response times on the server.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, oh, that's so fast. And then I was like, oh, yeah, it's cached, right? All the way down. So now like I'll go into Tinker, which is like Laravel's REPL, similar to like booting up IEX to make changes in the database if you need to. I'll make some changes and I'll be like, okay, well, what do I do? How do I make this live? You know? But yeah, and all that to say, yes, PHP also has type hinting.
I love how you just get directly to the point.
It always comes back. We've been doing this 5 years. I'm a pro.
You don't get 230 episodes in by getting directly to the point.
I'm a boomerang. I'm like a boomerang.
Okay, boomerang. Anyway, I didn't have a lot else to say about Python other than, I'm just utilizing, like I said, I try to utilize all the latest and greatest static type checking, hinting. I'm using AutoPEP 8 for formatting. So it just formats on save in VS Code. And man, it's one of the things that just like, you just, once you use it, you cannot live without it. I started, you know, I've been primarily developing my iMac. I went over to my MacBook and I started working on this code and I hit save and nothing happened. And I was like, what? It feels broken, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You're like, it didn't compile, right? Or like, it didn't, you know, something is broken.
Yeah, it didn't compile. And I don't have a preconceived notion for what I think Python code should look like. So I'm just willing to use whatever the formatter default is. And there is it's PEP number 8. It's one of the early Python, oh boy, PEPs, the Python EPs, extended play, that... Right. Obviously was important early on, and they've basically codified and now it's adopted into this plugin. And it's actually it just seems to do mostly the right thing. It lets me reformat things a little bit if I want to, which is nice. And so I've got auto formatting, got the type checking, it squiggly underlines everything. It just feels like a nice complete package. And I will say things that I miss so far. Holy crap, I missed the pipe operator. Like, there's so many functional, and I'm probably thinking about this the wrong way, but I want to do things, like you said, in a functional, procedural way. Mm-hmm. And I'm so used to, I mean, even Ruby doesn't have a pipe operator, but it has things like tap, and you can chain a bunch of things with dot notation and stuff. And I'm so used to thinking about that way of doing things, whereas Python's way of dealing with that is all these, like, sort of root level functions that are kind of baked into, like, the standard library as like the kernel, right? I don't know exactly what it's called, but they're imported for you automatically. Mm. And so you're dealing with all these root level functions and nesting and like, man, just give me a pipe. I just want to go from this to this to this. And it's hard because for pipe, you're so used to reading either left to right or top to down. Whereas when you're using the built-in sort of iterators and stuff, you have to read like inside out, which is almost like right to left.
Yeah.
Or bottom to top. And that's just driving me crazy now. Again, Elixir pipe operator has broken my brain, permanently rewired So that every time I go to reach forward, it's just like zap. It's like a dog collar. It's like, ah, nope, you can't do that. Stop it.
Yeah, I feel that definitely. PHP does have many of the Laravel things are sort of chainable, which is nice. I really miss using dots. I hate having to type two characters to call a method or something like that, right? Because it's the arrow, like hyphen greater than symbol. Luckily, PHP Storm, it kind of knows where you're at. Like if you're in an array and you hit tab, it'll auto insert the fat arrow, the rocket, I suppose. And if you're trying to access a method, you can auto add the arrow for you. But that took me a second to get used to. I would always get mad. I'm like, why do I have to type this? Why is it two?
Don't ever try to write any C++ code.
Yeah, yeah. Did I mention that we've had someone that comes to... I've been doing these Saturday morning code streams, and we've had someone swinging by that's really into C++, and they found some C++ web frameworks out there.
Sure, of course it's a thing. Why wouldn't that be a thing?
There are some interesting looking ones, but I haven't written C++ in a... I would never say I really wrote it. I mean, I tried to make games when I was a teenager, and I kicked around C++ a little bit, but yeah, that's one thing that bothered me about PHP a little bit was just the arrows, but thankfully PHP Storm sort of types them for me. Or the dollar sign variables too, that too, because PHP Storm will like auto append or prepend it to things for you. So I don't have to do it much. But if I'm in VS Code, it drives me insane.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. At least you have those nice ligatures and whatever font you're using there with the arrows and stuff.
JetBrains Mono.
Of course. Of course it's JetBrains. Why would it be anything other than JetBrains' own custom font?
I like it.
Thomas in the chat has reminded me that PEP stands for Python Enhancement Proposal.
It's cool that you're liking it, though. I enjoy when you come away with something that hasn't just like destroyed your week.
Yeah, and not only have I been learning the language, but I've actually been getting work done with it. So I've been doing this DevOps work for Glance, and basically I was able to recreate with Python what I have running now as a Rails application, like a full Rails application with a database and a cloud Elastic Beanstalk stack. This is a whole thing, right? And then I just replaced it with some Python scripts that use the first party AWS API, Boto 3 for some reason, which is very good and very well documented. And so I use the AWS API. I wrote my own little API client for some other stuff. And I have some Python stuff, and I figured out virtual environments. And now, like, when the server starts up, it runs all my little code, and it does exactly what it needs to do. So I'm actually, like, completing things with that. I'm not just doing this for fun. And it's been really, really nice so far. And I'm enjoying it so much. I'm really, really banking it on being my go-to, like, just mess around language.
Oh, yeah, you're saying
as opposed
that.
To Ruby, right? Like if I need to just do a little one-off process some files or do some stupid math in a terminal or just play around with, talk to some API or do some kind of automation, I'll always reach for Ruby, and I probably will for a while because I'm just so familiar with it and the standard library and everything. But man, I'd like to make Python that one thing, and I think I do. So I'm definitely reaching for that goal.
I've been reaching for Node more and more for that stuff, and I don't love it, honestly.
It gets a job done, though, and you know it pretty well.
Yeah, it gets a job done, and I'm familiar with JavaScript, at least, So I need to dig into the internals of Node more a little bit to kind of level up there. But yeah, I sort of have been... JavaScript is sort of my fallback stuff. Like, I really appreciate Laravel. Like, PHP is fine. I really appreciate Laravel specifically for how fast you can get to... It's on a server live, and it's functional and easy enough to maintain and add features to, right? And there's rules to follow, and there's tons of community there to you can bolt stuff on without having to worry about having to do too much from scratch. But yeah, I've been more and more... So for example, we had a few vendors send us folders of images. Like, oh, we don't have these on the web, so anywhere, like our website for some reason.
Oh my God.
So basically, I had to write a script that took them from a folder, rewrote the file name to be the product SKU, and then put them on an S3 folder that we have, that we control. And then it spits out a CSV with the SKU in one column and the images in multiple columns after that, right? So I just did it in Node. It took me an hour to get everything done and out the door. And then I went back to our data person and was like, here's the CSV. It'll work. Just merge it with the other sheet, you know? And it's fine. It wasn't amazing. It's very procedural code. It was not great, but it works. And I've used it a few times. So I figured I'm going to use it enough times to make me want to write a script, but not enough times to make me want a library, if that makes sense.
Oh, yeah, totally. There's definitely that middle ground that like 90% of use cases. As long as you document it and put it in version control somewhere and throw a README on it, like as far as I'm concerned, that is fair game.
It's just configured via env variables. You tell it where the image directory is.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You tell it like what the, you know, what S3 bucket it's going to. Super, super easy. And then, yeah, it's without a CSV. Our person can just merge it in to our Google Sheet that holds the data and then, you know, export it as that out of CSV and pull it into the system. So, I mean, heck, we could probably even use the Google Sheet API at some point. We have so much data in Google Sheets, though, that there's actually a sheet and a row limit? you can hit a row limit in Google Sheets. So we had to create Vendor Project 2.
Oh, my God.
There's like 60 sheets in the first one, like 60 tabs at the bottom. It's all co-located. And then there's a plugin that we use that I will highly, highly recommend. So I talked about OpenRefine a while back, right? Having to process CSVs and replace characters or replace sequences in cells or, you know, just whatever you have to do. And so what I've been having to do is, and me and Adam, our data person, we'll download a CSV, pull it in OpenRefine, do the transformation, and pull it back into Google Sheets. It turns out that there's a plugin, I'll put it in the show notes, but it does all the stuff that you would need to do in OpenRefine, but it just does it in Google Sheets. It costs like a couple bucks a month for the company, so we don't care. And you can kind of do it all in one spot, which is great. Yeah, but honestly, like before you were mentioned Python, I had thought about like, is Python something I should pick up? Because Python is like the go-to for data manipulation, right? Like that seems to be like, that's one case that Python really has nailed down. The community has really nailed it down. And so I was considering going that route, but then I just was like, nah, I should just reach for Node because I'm already trying to learn PHP over here and I don't need to add another one as I do too much or too often. So that's kind of what pushed me back into just having Node be my fallback.
Yeah, I don't know what it is with Python in the scientific mathematical community, whether they just, those type of people just gravitated towards it or whether it just, you know, it reached some critical mass, just happened to. I don't think there's anything particular about the language that makes it well-suited to number crunching, except I would say maybe the ability to, you know, add C extensions, or maybe I can think of memory usage as another advantage. I was reading some stuff today about ways, like it's very, very easy to sort of optimize memory usage when you have large data sets. Like when you have a class, you can specify exactly what, you know, what the members are, so it doesn't waste memory, like trying to make room for other, not members, they call them attributes on a class. And then also things like when you're doing, the first party support for iterating through things is basically like how a stream works in Elixir. It just does things like one item at a time, right? So whenever you're iterating over thing, unless you explicitly cast to a list, you basically just want to be passing around iterators everywhere and everything consumes them and everything can generate them and they're all kind of interoperable. So that's kind of nice. So, yeah, I don't know. That also did kind of draw me to it. I mentioned before GNU Radio, which is a digital signal processing library where all the official bindings for it are in Python. And as far as I can tell, no one has written usable bindings for any other language, which is too bad. But now I'm empowered to use that. And so I'm really excited to start playing around with that.
Yeah, I mean, well, the quality of life things you mentioned before, I think, go a long way for me specifically. And Elixir's really catching up with VS Code. Like, the Elixir LS plugin for VS Code's come a long way since it was sort of taken over and revitalized. Shout out to Jake Becker for doing what he did. But now the new crew, it's coming light years ahead. But going to, like, PHP Storm, or you know, I've been doing a lot of React lately. And React plus WebStorm is amazing. It's like pretty good with Vue too, but like the React ones, it feels like it's a little bit on another level. And the project that I'm working on right now, I decided to, instead of trying to pick up like CSS and JS or any fancy libraries, I'm just writing a CSS file with the same component name next to the component, and I'm just using BEMs, you know, BEM prefixing basically, or like class.
Oh no, writing. You got to back up there. What does that mean? BEMs?
Block element modifier. So if you've ever looked at CSS and you see like product container underscore underscore product title, product container underscore underscore, so everything's flat, right? You don't have like a bunch of nested selectors. Let me send you a website for you to look at, actually. It's just a naming convention for your classes. That's really all it is.
See, this flies in the face of using a post CSS plugin that emulates SAS, so I can just nest my things as deeply as possible. This is the opposite of that. You know, I've viewed a lot of source code for pages that where this pattern shows up, and I guess I never really just made the connection that this is actually a standard.
Yeah, it's supposed to be better for obviously large things and many people working in tandem, right?
Yeah, because it prevents namespace collisions, basically. I think it's the idea, right?
Yeah, and you look at something and you know exactly what it is, where it's at, and especially like when something is a modifier, when something is like an element, when something is like a container wrapper.
This also completely flies in the face of what Tailwind tries to do.
Yeah, I mean, this is a code test, so I didn't want to use Tailwind out of fear of what if they hate it. Because part of the qualifications are we want to know you can write CSS, and so Tailwind isn't me writing CSS.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so like with WebStorm, I'm like command B-ing on a class, and it's taking me into the style sheet where it's defined, and command Y on it, or Alt F7 on it, and it shows me all of the elements in whatever React components are actually using.
Alt F7? Are you even using a Mac, dude? What is going on over there? Alt F7.
Alt F7 in WebStorm or JetBrains, it just shows you references. What things are using this?
Sean, my MacBook doesn't even have an F7 key, nor does it have an Alt key.
Your MacBook has an F7 key. Well, technically it doesn't because you have a touch bar, so.
I have an Option key and a touch bar.
Option F7, you know what I mean.
It's the most un-Mac-like thing. Just trolling.
Yeah, I don't know. It treats CSS like a programming language. You can jump to definition. You can view references. You can like rename the symbol and it changes it all in the markup, or you can rename the symbol in the markup and it changes the class definition. Feeling real productive with it feels good. But anyway, you're talking about like having that first, you know, class like support for like linting and what's it like formatting I don't know, like you could get a lot of work done without those, but when you have them, they're nice to have. And when you suddenly don't have them, you miss them a lot.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So tell me a little bit more about this React project. So,
here we go.
Yeah, let's go. Get me fired up. You're doing some React. This is a, remind me again, this is a code interview for a potential job. That's right. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, well, yeah. And I figured, it's an area that if I'm thinking I'm wanting to look for other positions, it's like good to have on a resume, having some experience or being able to talk intelligently about it. You have a lot of Vue experience, and it's been years since I used React. So either way, I figured it was probably time to poke around a little bit more. But yeah, the one thing that I'm working on now, or you know, they're actually off for the rest of the week, so I don't have to send it until next week, but is building a React it's a simple application, but I think for the last 2 weeks, I've been sort of digging into React when I have time. It hasn't been a lot of time just because with Sidedoor launching or letting people in, you know, I've been busy, but it's been interesting.
You mentioned WebStorm. Anything else new going on there in React world that you've been picking up on? We obviously spent a lot of time going back and forth about Redux and you're doing stuff with like higher order components and functions. It's kind of scary sounding.
Well, let's back up a little bit. Yeah, like Redux is something I dug into. I have experience there before. And Redux, the library itself is really small anyway. But it's what I'm finding with React is like its middle name is Ceremony. It's there's a lot of ceremony. So like React itself, on the tin of it, at least JSX is like really simple. It's like small, it's kind of contained. But what makes React difficult is all of the ideas around it that you have to be aware of or know. And a lot of those ideas stem from the fact that React itself, or at least JSX, is really simple. Mm-hmm. Just the view layer, right? So it leaves you to sort of construct all the other stuff around it. So Redux is one pattern that's used a lot for state management. You know, similar to Vue, I mean, like Vue, you still have to learn how to, like, you know, you should probably send data down and emit actions up, or, you know, something similar like that. Like one-way data flow is probably important to learn about, things like that. But React is definitely a deeper learning curve, in my opinion, because it does less to put that stuff together for you, or it used to, than Vue does. And it doesn't feel true when I say it, but it feels true when I'm using the two libraries, if that makes sense.
You can feel, that's where you feel the friction when you're actually going doing it.
When I'm thinking about React, right, you already said Redux for state management, right? You know, so moving all your state into one spot and having, you know, multiple reducers that you can stitch together. But at the end of the day, you have one reducer because Redux expects a single reducer. So you have to combine your reducers via the combine reducer function, or with the Redux toolkit, you have to use, you basically pass all your slices into it and it stitches everything together in one thing. So I've gone past Redux. Am I cool? I feel comfortable using this again. Redux stunk, like we talked about, having to adopt a pattern to do asynchronous things with Redux, right? So wrapping a function that returns another function. There's a whole lot of patterns around that as well. But then we go deeper. And so, like, I've been trying to keep it as vanilla as I can. So we get rid of Redux. And then I'm thinking, okay, how does state management work with React? There are tons of bolt-on libraries that are sort of like single stores. But how does React want you to manage state? Well, they have this thing called the Context API.
This is relatively new, right? Because I remember this being kind of a controversial thing when it came in recently.
2018.
That's recent.
Right, yeah. That's what I thought, too. And I was like, wait, 2018? When I first read it, I was like, this seems... Well, the Context API has been around. It was just a private API they told you not to use. Hmm. Redux actually used it under the hood. But you weren't supposed to use a Context API until they... That's called the legacy Context API. The new Context API is different. So, okay. So, like, say you have a bunch of components. Like, you have app, and then you might have sidebar, and you might have your main area, and then you have like a list and the list item components. Well, without any sort of state management, you sort of have to make the, at least make up a container or use the highest common parent as like a place to store your state, right?
Sure.
And then you have to do what's called prop drilling. So where you pass props and data down through a component to get it to another component that's a descendant.
Yeah.
Right.
Yep.
So React calls that prop drilling. So you can do that and hate life, I suppose. but if you're not using Redux or another bolt-on solution, you could reach for the Context API. And so here, like, I'll explain it here and try not to like exclaim too much because you're not gonna like it. But
please don't tell me it's a global singleton.
I mean, it can be, but it doesn't have to be.
Okay.
So you can have many contexts, right? So you might have a current user context. You might have product data context. You might have your theme context. Is it light theme? Is it dark theme? What are the dark theme colors? What are light theme colors? And so when you create a context, it's literally a function called create context. It gives you two components, a consumer and a provider, out the other side. And you wrap whatever container you want to have access to the data in the provider. So let's say that you're using a theme and you're using, or the current user, and you have a user menu. You want to wrap the user menu component or anything above that level in a current user provider. Mm-hmm. And that'll inject the stuff. And then when you're in the current user component, you wrap that component in a current user consumer, which does the work for pulling the data, the current state from the provider that's above in the tree, right? So you have your provider, which provides the data, and you have your consumer, which consumes the data, right? Your provider goes somewhere above in the tree. So if many components need to know about your current user provider goes high up in the tree above all of them, right? And then any of them can just directly wrap themselves in the consumer and they have access to that data.
What was that you said before about too much ceremony?
But wait, if you're using hooks,
there's more.
If you're using hooks, you don't need the consumer component itself. You can just use context, pass the context, like you import the context, use context, pass the context into the hook, and then you have access to the data, right? So you don't have to use the consumer component. But either way, you have to wrap something higher up in the tree in the provider component to have access to it. But you might ask, what happens if we have a component that needs access to more than one context?
What if we have a component that needs access to more than one context, John?
Well, you just nest it in the consumer components, or you use context more than once.
Just rocking back and forth over here.
Yeah, but then you destructure your stuff out of your context, and you just have it. So that way you don't have to prop drill. It's built into React. There's nothing third party about it. It's all right there. Nothing extra. It's just built into the library.
You know what I do with Vue? I do dot inject, and then I just do $ this dot $ whatever I just injected, mm-hmm. and it comes out. Which I realize is being hypocritical, because I just made fun
the
of
global, singleton.
Global singletons, but it's actually a good pattern for yeah. web applications, it turns out.
So that's what context is, really. And I'm using the provider. In my case, I really just have one. It's a small enough app where everything can just have one context, and then just wrap it around the application component, like the root component. And then I just use context in whatever component needs to pull the data out. So
the consumer can be many levels deep mm-hmm. within the provider. It doesn't have to be a direct sibling or child, I should say. Mm-hmm. Gotcha. Okay, so yep. I can see that. I can see that a little more.
So it's like mini flux patterns without like dispatching and stuff. So if you need to have a function that changes state, you just export that function with the context and then pull it in wherever you need it. You just call that function.
Okay, so you've gone through all the ceremony. You've wired up your state through 17 different decoupled things. Is there a performance benefit there? Is there a reusable architecture benefit there? Why, Sean?
What do you mean, like reusable?
I'm just saying, like, what's the goal of this? What does this actually achieve for you besides just prop drilling being a pain in the butt?
So you don't have to prop drill, and you don't have to pull in a third party. Library like Redux or something else.
Okay.
It's like the vanilla way of handling that without prop drilling.
Right. Because if you don't want to prop drill, then you'd end up with just one big state object, and then you're just passing that one object around, and then you have Redux basically.
yeah. And there are performance things you can do. So like React with Hook specifically, there's like use memo and use callback. So you can mm-hmm. memoize stuff. You can basically cache it, right? So I guess like if people don't know what memoize is, basically you can memoize a function and it won't evaluate the function or whatever's inside again until the given arguments are different. So it's a cache. You gave me the two same things. I'm just going to give you what you got back before. I have seen that in Vue or Vue's documentation, but that's something you have to do in React. You have to memoize stuff and you have to know about when to do that, because that can actually hurt performance, because it has to store that stuff and look at, right? So if you're memoizing stuff all over the place, well, then you might actually be hurting your performance by forcing additional checks on that information. So,
or you could be invalidating your cache incorrectly, depending on the side effects, and you got to use that memory to store the results.
Yeah, so that's my experience in React so far. It's a deeper pool, in my opinion, up front. Like Vue, you can go like as deep as you want to, right? With functional components and scoped slots and composing things that way. And of course, Vue 3 has the composition API, which is similar to React Hooks, which I actually really like React Hooks, by the way. It can get squirrely, but for most things, it's like nice. It's a nice way of working, right? But up to front, to me, like React is like throwing you into the deep end, whereas Vue is like you can choose to walk to the deep end if you want.
And then drown.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I don't hate it. Like there are certain things that I enjoy with React. Like you can have as many, you know, it's just a function that turns JSX. You throw, it takes an object like props in, and it's like, it can be really simple. It's all the other things that you have to do when you have to decide about state man. It's like you can have really simple React apps and they can be fine. I think that there's also a push to, I don't know if it's because like job requirement listings, like Redux, context API, like you have to know about all these complicated things for working on big complicated React apps, but it doesn't have to be that way. They can be really small, really efficient, really easy to maintain.
It's like, I saw this quote recently. It was something like, along the lines of, and you're familiar with Sinatra, right, and Rails.
Mm-hmm.
Someone said, like, every Sinatra app is doomed to just recreate Rails poorly. Because you end up pulling in all the things, conveniences that Rails does for you anyways, database access, active record, you know, handling MIME types and returning results and rendering things and templating, and suddenly you've built a poor Rails clone. And same thing with React, right? Like, or even Vue, honestly. Like, you can sprinkle in a little bit here and there and get some really, really nice functionality for a very small benefit. But once you start scaling up and building full applications on the same, if you try to use that same framework, it's just gonna fall down. So obviously the tools have a place.
Yeah, and so like we talked about Redux, well, there's a hook called useReducer. And the idea of a reducer is really simple. It's just a function that takes the current state, an action that is supposed to happen, and then that function does the thing and returns a full state tree. Like, the idea of a reducer is really simple. So you have useReducer, you pass it a reducer function, you pass it an initial state object, and you can just pull that in and use it wherever. So actually for my small app, I actually am using useReducer. So I have a very, very small Redux-like setup where I can actually dispatch actions. So like select repository and remove repository, things like that, right? But as soon as you have to do something more complicated, like, okay, well, what if I want to move my async, like my API requests out of my form component? What if I want to put them somewhere else? Okay, well, the next logical place to do that would be in your store, right? Your Redux store. Okay, well, Redux out of the box doesn't have support for asynchronous requests or asynchronous actions.
Are you sure? I could have sworn it did. No?
Not out of the box. So Redux Thunk used to be, it's created by the team that created Redux. It used to be included. They removed it. So there's literally no actual built-in support for async actions in Redux. You have to pull in Thunk. So of course you can do that really simply, right? Like I said, Thunk is just a function that returns another function that will be called later. You know, you can make your own used Thunk reducer in 10 lines of code. And then you could add middleware if you wanted to, like inject, like put a console log or whatever in front of it. You still have to do it. You still have to know about the pattern. You still have to know about the pitfalls. So then you're inclined to like, well, maybe I should just leave the API request in the form component. So, yeah, I feel I do want to give a shout out to like Frontend Masters though. Frontend Masters is a great, great platform. So I've watched a lot of video tutorials, like Egghead has some good ones. The Egghead ones are really short and concise. It's like you want to get to the content, you'll learn about context API in 5 minutes. It like flies through it, but there's no extra fluff there. Frontend Masters is more on the other side where it's like they hire people to come in and they give a full day workshop on a topic and you just watch the video of them giving the workshop, people answering questions or asking questions and stuff like that. But the quality on Frontend Masters is great. I've also subscribed to Pluralsight in the past, and Frontend Masters quality is like vastly superior in the topics they cover. So Frontend Masters has really good JavaScript content, really good React content, but there's also really good JavaScript learning, like full on like 3 days worth of content on functional programming with JavaScript, 3 days like content worth of like the deep internals of JavaScript, like JavaScript, the hard parts, like in a course, basically. They have like some really good content in there that I'm actually like really enjoying digging into.
Is this an ad read? Did I not get the memo? Do we have a promo code?
I've conversed with I think his name is Mark in the past. I said something about them in the past and he gave me a free sub for a while because of whatever I said. I don't recall exactly, but no, like the content is great. It's like really good. I wouldn't want to talk about it if it wasn't really good, and it's really good.
No, that's really cool. That's awesome. I assume they have Vue.js resources over there as well.
They do have Vue resources. They also have like Node resources. There's a Go course. There's GraphQL courses. There's a course, a 4-hour course on building your own programming language. It talks about lexing, parsing, tokenization, ASTs, all that stuff. CSS, of course, accessibility. Yeah, I don't know. Covers sort of the gamut of front end side anyway.
Cool. This is cool. So check this out.
But yeah, I've consumed a lot of resources and read a lot of articles on React, and Frontend Masters was like the thing that made me feel like, oh, I know this now.
That's cool.
Yeah.
I have one final question here before I wrap up. So you love Nuxt. Nuxt came from Next, which is a React project. Have you looked at Next at all?
I have, but I have not used it because the projects I've worked on have not required it.
Okay, I was just wondering if you had done any dive into sort of what Next provides for you out of the box.
I mean, not deeply. I have looked at it and I've heard a lot about it. The reason why I haven't tried to use it yet is because I didn't feel like I had a good enough grasp on the other things first.
Okay, totally fair. Just wondering.
Yeah.
Come back next week when you've rewritten everything in Next. It'll be fine.
Right. I think more than anything, like, it makes me appreciate Vue more. Because I would say I miss Vue when I'm doing front-end stuff. I don't hate React. My review of it was, it's fine. I prefer Vue. But more so than anything, it makes me really appreciate the upcoming composition API that Vue will have with hooks. Like, actually, I have this one starred. It's called React Use, and basically it's just a list of React hooks. And it's got, like, everything in here. And they're so, like, the source is so simple because they do one thing, right? Like, use battery. You can use the use battery hook, and it just gives you an object of, like, battery stats of your device.
Oh, what?
Yeah. Use geolocation. I've used that one. It's great. You, like, use geolocation, and it gives you the geolocation stuff, like your lat long, you know, all that stuff, the timestamp. You can even tell it to watch, so you can turn on watch mode for the geolocation API. And again, like, these are all, my favorite thing about them is, like, you go from having to pull in these big libraries to pulling in these like these Unix-like functions in a way, right? Very isolated in scope.
I like the way you described that Unix-like, because that really is the philosophy here, right? This is cool. This is very, very cool. Kind of pick and choose.
Exactly. If you need it, you pull it. If you don't, you don't. And that it is what it is. You get, it's like very super simple looking. The source is super simple. And again, like the composition, this is basically what the composition API is for Vue.
Yeah. See, use media tracking CSS media queries. This is I do this on Vue because I can't just rely on CSS media queries to get everything done. I actually need to completely relay out my application and what components are on the screen at any given time, based off of media queries. And yeah, there's a library for it. But this is cool because it just injects it using a sort of known API and way of doing things. I like that.
Or like use local storage. You know, local storage isn't hard to use, but it wraps it up for you. Mm-hmm. Use clipboard, or there's one called Clippy that's just like clipboard access.
Oh no.
Yeah, I mean there's stuff for everything. Like I said, use Thunk Reducer as one if you needed to use that. There's like, I'm using debouncing one because GitHub limits unauthenticated API search requests to 10 per minute. If you're signed in as 30, but otherwise it's 10. And if you're building an autocomplete or auto suggest tool for GitHub searching, you're gonna hit 10 real quick.
So there's lots of individual functions here, but they're all under one library, right? Just called React Use, and provides them all, and you just pick whatever one you want, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this is one of my problems with the JavaScript ecosystem, is that there's not enough hub libraries like this, like core libraries that everyone uses and understands and do a lot of things. And I'm not just, obviously, like the big frameworks and stuff there are, but for sort of utility things where you have to bring in, I mean, there's like 17 different ways to like format a date. Like, why can't we have a nice standard library that builds on top of JavaScript's crappy standard library that everyone just kind of uses? Like, I know underscore, and obviously jQuery was like kind of filled that role for a while. And man, yeah. I just miss that in the modern JavaScript world. Is some library like this that is so general purpose, and then you know it's going to be maintained because it does so much and everyone uses it, versus like tiny packages that just get abandoned or exploited or, you know, removed or who knows.
Yeah.
And just a small sidebar gripe there, but this is cool.
Yeah, this one seems to be pretty popular. There's a couple more like it. And then there's, of course, like 17 different, you know, use geolocations and 17 different use audios or whatever. But this one seems to be, has been working really well for me. And I actually have seen several people mention it. So I feel better using it, but yeah, I really like this way of building, like you said, sort of the Unix-y functions that you pull in that do a single thing. They're only concerned with doing a single thing. You use them where you need them and you don't where you don't need them. And it just works.
I also like browsing through this because it gives you an idea of, oh, I can just do this Like, you didn't know you could do the thing until you knew that you could do the thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, you can't just browse libraries, but if a library has lots of functionality, you can browse the functionality. And, oh, I can use media devices? Wow, I could, what can I do with that?
The other nice thing is that there's also React Hook Linter that will lint your hooks if you're writing custom hooks to make sure you don't do anything that's known to be bad. You know, so like use effect is one of the built-in standard React hooks that you put side effects in, API calls, things to local storage, things that should happen asynchronously that you need to know about, you put inside use effect. The first argument is just a function, an anonymous function. The second argument is a dependency tree. So you can actually tell React which dependencies it needs to watch for. When those dependencies change, it runs the effect again. It's like views watch, right? But if you forget to put something in the tree, it can either A, cause an infinite loop, or cause a thing to never run again. You know, so you have to be aware actually of what you're doing with use effect, how you're using the dependencies and things like that. Otherwise, there's like non-obvious bugs that happen. And so the linter for React hooks will say, oh, hey, here's a dependency that you forgot to add, or like, hey, don't use this use effect inside this other thing over here. It sort of gives you general advice on how to use it. So that was also like a nice thing.
You know what we call lint hooks? Velcro.
But that's what my thought on React is. It's like, it's fine. It's a deeper pool up front, but it's fine. I prefer Vue, but React is fine. So I'm feeling more productive with it anyway. So
That's good. That's really, really important. Plus, I make way more money being a React dev than an Elixir dev. Let's be honest here.
I don't know. I don't know about that. Elixir? I guess it depends, but I would think that depends on geography and things like that. But I would think that
the job pool is a lot larger. Say that.
Yeah, the job pool is a lot larger. But I would also say there's more competition and there's more. With Elixir, I would say the jobs are more specialized. And in my mind, if the job is more specialized and dealing, especially with dealing with real time, to me, that's a pretty important position that might need to pay well to make sure that those things don't break.
I'm just waiting for the day you come to me with your iOS app that you've written in React Native.
That's next. But we should probably bring the recording down and start the after show.
What? An hour 10? We're just getting started, man.
I didn't even talk about iOS betas that I said I wouldn't install last week. I definitely installed them both. And I didn't even get to talk about tiling window managers.
It's probably for the best.
I'll talk about it. And you will all be using Amethyst soon enough. But I guess this is where I ask for feedback, right? If anyone has any thoughts on my thoughts on React, I'd actually be really interested to know, because I haven't conversed. I've stayed out of the React Deflux Discord, and I haven't tried to get into React's Twitter. So if anyone has ideas on my thoughts on React or Rockwell's thoughts on Python, let us know.
You can tweet us those thoughts on Twitter. The show is DNCcast. Sean is Sean Washbot, and I am Shrockwell.
And if you can hear that chomping, it's Watson stuffing his face full of kibble.
I can hear that.
You can? Yeah, he's eating food right next to me. Everything we mentioned on the libraries, like AutoPep8 and Typinning and things like that, we put in the show notes. So if you're interested in the show notes, head on over to dnc.show.
Sean's going to rewrite it in React. It's going to be great.
Oh,
we're
no.
Also streaming on Twitch every Thursday night, 6 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Eastern. You can come be in the chat, hang out, be a part of the show, give us your feedback in real time so that you can make us look like idiots faster than ever before.
Yeah, or you can make me call out names like Soggy Pants.
Shout out Soggy Pants.
Thanks for the follow, Soggy Pants. What's next? And as always, thanks to Spec for having us and putting us out there into the world, getting this thing started back in the day, 5 years ago now. So if you're interested in other design and development related podcasts, head on over to spec.fm and check them out.
We get Watson on the show next week. So give you some like squeaky toys or something so we can contribute.
There are two toys. They both have squeakers, and somehow he has not squeaked them yet. He is good for working out, though. I was holding him doing some squats earlier.
That's pretty good. I like it. It's good resistance training.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I'll catch up with you next week, Rockwell.
All right, talk to you later.